British Spy Stories, Season 1. Spy or Traitor? Episode 4. Gabby pushes back the wardrobe door in the safe house and enters a small hidden room that contains the comms equipment for this location. She goes to a bank of computers on the left-hand side, pulls out her mobile, and plugs it directly into one of the machines. She opens an app, and a range of proxy locations appear on the screen. She chooses Barcelona and runs the program. A message is displayed on the phone. Network proxied to Barcelona, node 238DT. She puts in a wireless earpiece and stabs the final connecting switch to bring her on grid. A voice comes through the speakers.
Blackhawk, nice to hear from you at last.
Morning, Cabinet Maker. How are you?
Mustn't grumble, you know. How's Barcelona?
She pulls up the Barcelona weather forecast on a second screen.
It's been lovely these past couple of days, but looking a bit shit now, to be honest, she says.
Gabrielle is running a voice stress detector on the screen to her right to tell if Cabinet Maker is relaxed or under pressure. The stress chart is climbing. She guesses he is being puppeted, taking direct orders from a senior officer in his earpiece.
We were worried about you, he says.
I'm fine, just being careful after the news from the other day, says Gabby.
We were wondering if you could come into the consulate in Barcelona and debrief.
More than happy to do that in a day or two, Cab.
We were hoping sooner, he says.
She gets up from the seat and paces the room.
Not possible, I'm afraid. I have things to do.
The stress chart jumps on the screen. Cabinet Maker is a junior ops room clerk. She met him once and he was timid. She cannot be sure if the jump was just his natural nervousness or something else.
What's the latest intel on the Stranraer investigation?
She says.
We're checking. All the protocols seem to have been followed.
She is getting frustrated.
Don't tell me you lot have been sitting on your arse for 2 days after we lost someone in the field.
We have nothing more. The crows are all over it, but have come up with nothing, he says, using the nickname for the MI6 investigations branch.
The stress chart is right at the top of the screen now. Cabinet Maker isn't used to being puppeted, or is just out of practice.
I need to go, Cap. Talk later.
She had wanted to give London a second chance to indicate that they were progressing the investigation on Mac. But the call had shown her that nothing has changed. This was a point of no return. Now, she's on her own. Catherine pulls out her mobile phone and taps the decrypt key. Only 3 other people are sitting in the restaurant on Neuschwanstrasse, in the centre of Zurich city centre. Her boyfriend has sent pictures of his new flat in Park Street, Mayfair. She doesn't trust him. Too confident by half. She is sure that he sleeps with other women, but can't prove it. She needs to find out more when she's in London this weekend. A message pings into the device.
Damn it,
she says under her breath, and pulls back her blonde hair from her face. She has been hoping for no more work this week. The screen shows a subject line. 653/6.1. She opens the message. It contains the usual instructions, a grid reference and a time. 6:30, tonight. The location is a villa on the outskirts of Zurich. Catherine would have given anything not to go, but once you sign up, it is impossible to get out of work when it does come through. She is allocated to northern Italy and Switzerland. The dedicated patch strategy is a change from the old days,
when people were deployed anywhere across the world. They had to fly long haul to complete an order. Long haul isn't the best experience just before you have to work. And you have to be fit to do this job. Almost like an athlete. She takes care of her diet and only eats things that will keep her weight within 4 pounds of her optimum. She goes to the gym every other day and can outrun all the men on the treadmill. Catherine picks up her weekend suitcase and walks back to her flat around the corner. She drops down into the basement car park and starts her Jaguar F-Type. She drives out of the town and up into the hills. She parks in the woods off to one side of the mountain road. Catherine gets out and makes a wide sweep on foot of the valley where the house lies. She checks a map of the area surrounding the house, as well as the floor plan of the property that she has been sent by phone. She gets back to her Jaguar and drives further up the road, then dives down a track that leads to the edge of the land owned by the house. She walks through the trees until she reaches the top of a wooded slope that leads down to the rear of the property. There are two guards that she can see, one on each side of the terrace. But she can tell that they're amateurs from the way they stand. No military training is apparent. They mostly stay in the same spot, but one of them occasionally retreats to the corner of the building for a cigarette. She repositions herself along the slope so that she can see the smoking place. She silently drops down from the top of the rise. She moves quickly, almost flying. Catherine appears from the wood, 10 feet from the man. She runs up behind him and pushes a knife silently between two ribs. The lights in his eyes dim instantly, and he slumps to the ground. She checks where the other guy is, but he's on the far side of the land and has seen nothing. Catherine runs to the side door that will give her access to the villa. She opens the door, draws her Silence Beretta handgun from the holster on her back, and steps inside. She can hear a man talking on a telephone in the next room. Catherine treads gently across the space until she is against the door frame and within 20 feet of him. She has one shot to make this work, as the other guard will hear and block her exit route. The man on the telephone is pacing up and down, talking about arrangements for importing something or other. He is facing the doorway where she is hiding.
"Come on, Marker," she whispers under her breath. "Just move around a tiny bit."
He does move around. She takes 3 paces, pushes the Beretta into his torso, and pulls the trigger. A dull thud echoes around the room. He tries to call out. She takes the weight of his body as his eyes close and his limbs collapse onto each other. Catherine lays him down on the wooden floor. He opens his eyes for a second and looks at her. But there is no emotion, and they close before he can say anything. She turns back to the doorway and runs to the side door. The other guard is nowhere in sight, and she sprints across the garden and up into the wood. Catherine stops at the top of the slope and checks for the guard, but he's not there. She jogs back to her car, and her body slips down into the driving seat. She stows her Beretta in the hidden housing on the dash. The engine roars, and she drives back through the lanes until she reaches the junction with the main road. Catherine turns the car back towards the town and accelerates away from the scene. She gains speed along a straight stretch of road and steams around the next corner. As she passes a side road, a Porsche pulls out behind her, but initially she thinks nothing of it. The Porsche more than keeps up with her speed and slowly closes the gap between them. At each straight section, the Porsche gets closer until it is 30 feet from her back bumper. She tries to see the face of the driver, but they have their visor down and sunglasses on. At the next corner, the two cars scream around the bend at over 60 miles an hour. The Porsche accelerates and starts to pass her. The next bend is no more than 10 seconds ahead. The Porsche draws level with her window and maintains the position. As Catherine starts to think that the Porsche won't make the next corner, the side window rolls down and a handgun is raised by the driver. Two shots ring out. The first smashes the side window, and the second hits the inside of the door beside her. Catherine brakes right at the start of the curve in the road, but the Porsche doesn't slow and barely makes the corner before regaining control and speeding off. She pulls over and sits motionless, taking in the events of the past minute. A trickle of blood drops down her cheek from the glass fragments that have grazed her skin. She looks in the rear view mirror. She has 3 or 4 cuts across her face. She stabs a button on the car's console.
"Voice message to London Centre," she says out loud.
A red light flicks on the panel above her head.
"Agent Coniston, I have completed job 653/6.1 successfully. The job itself was fine, but afterwards I was followed by an assailant and sustained fire. 2 rounds, no injuries. The assailant appears to have been waiting for me. I can only think that the kill location was leaked. Suggest you explore any network security issues. Message ends."
She wipes the blood from her face, drops the clutch, and heads for the airport. The light from the upper window moves across Stuart's face. He opens his eyes for the first time in what seems like months, but isn't. He looks around the hospital ward as it comes into focus. Lying still, his brain automatically starts to go through what he can remember of the events that led to him being in this bed. The cafe, the car, the running, the man with the knife.
"Herr Palmer,"
a voice comes from the doorway and a nurse walks in.
"How do you feel?"
"Tired, but not in pain," he says. She smiles at him and checks his pulse.
"Am I all right?"
"A little infection in the wound," she says.
"You'll need to stay here for a couple of days, but you should be all right to go home after that."
"Can I make a telephone call?" he says.
It is Geraldine, in the office, who answers the call. She seems very pleased to hear from him, and tells him that everything has been sorted out while he's been away. Malcolm took on the policy paper about trade, and Sally from accounts found someone else to do the analysis of healthcare services for British expats in Germany. She speaks as though he has been away on a business trip rather than the victim of a stabbing.
"How do you feel, Stuart?"
she asks eventually.
"Not bad," he says.
There is a British pause as they struggle to find the words that show some caring without being too forward.
"We've all missed you, Stuart."
"Thank you, Geraldine. It'll be good to get back and see you."
"When are you coming out?"
she says.
"A while yet. There's an infection, apparently."
"Will they allow visiting?"
says Geraldine.
"Yes."
"I might come and see you, then."
"That would be nice," he says.
They hang on to the telephone line, each wanting to hear themselves say something more deeply felt.
"I'll come in tomorrow,"
she says.
"Right."
They ring off and, in the office, Geraldine is lost in her own thoughts. Jim is late. He arrives in a fluster, having been held up by some last-minute analyses needed before the opening of the Asian markets. Gabby hasn't seen Jim Cartwright for 6 years. They worked together in the Metropolitan Police Specialist Decryption Team, which was part of her training. Jim borders on genius when it comes to numbers and finding patterns in data. He left the police and moved into international banking in London's Docklands area. She booked a table at the Elephant Royal restaurant, as she knows he likes Thai food. She asked for a table overlooking the river, so that she can see the water. They chat for an hour about people they know and what they've been doing. With Jim, she uses her real name, but her cover story has always been that she works in a law firm as an investigator. She has a fictional boyfriend, Ralph, and they have a flat together in Fulham. Over the months and years, she has become quite fond of some of the fictional people in her cover stories. When in Berlin, she has a particularly lovely fictional uncle who lives in Munich, who she visits regularly. He sounds so kind and is the sort of person she wishes she knew in real life. After a while, Gabrielle thinks the time is right to move the conversation on to what she came for.
I wanted to ask you, Jim.
Far away.
We have a case running currently,
she begins.
And I have to find out if there are any patterns in the emails that were sent between various people in this client's company.
What sort of data? He asks.
Strings of messages, data, time codes, that sort of thing,
she says, pulling out a USB stick from her pocket and placing it down between them.
We anonymized all the data, so we're not breaking any Data Protection Act stuff.
How much data is on here? He picks up the stick.
4 terabytes?
He widens his eyes.
She adds, how long would it take?
A week.
Can you do anything in 3 or 4 days? We've got a court date coming up.
She flicks her eyes up to his and smiles. I'll do my best, Gab. Look, I need to get back to work. Sorry, the Chinese markets are having a big announcement and I'm needed. He pauses. Really nice to see you again.
You too, Jim. Look after yourself.
I'll message you when this is done, he says. Then walks away. Gabrielle raises her hand to order another glass of wine, as she wants time to just think. She has started to feel lonely for the first time in a long while, and gets out her phone. She flicks through her contacts and chooses one, then auto-dials. A man answers.
Rich, it's Gabby. What are you doing tonight? Fancy a drink?
A pause while she listens.
Great. New flat? Ping me the address. I'll come over.
She sits, staring for a few moments, thinking about her life. The waitress comes up. Gabby cancels the wine, pays the bill, and goes out into the street. She clambers into a waiting cab.
Park Street, Mayfair, please.